Well, if you'd stayed and finished your shift, you'd be in the clear, wouldn't you? The doorbell rings. Hey, wonderful people, how you doing? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I do truly appreciate that you've joined me for this episode. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Billy Livingston bring us our first story. It's titled, What Ivy Brings. It's mid-morning when I get home from an all-nighter, and the sunlight is acid in my eyes. Locking the front door, I stand there in my scrubs. The house is quiet, but there's dread in the air. Maybe it's just me. Must be, what, 25 hours since I slept? When you work in a long-term care facility, the nursing shortage is constant. Always a double shift on offering, if you're willing. Claire? My sister walks out from the kitchen. She's stuffed into a pair of pants that are so tight she's got to undo the top button. Once upon a time, those things were loose on her, lounge pants. Now she wears a long black shirt to hide the muffin top. Hard to believe this is the same girl who once strutted around lithesome in tailored suits, knocking every cop on his butt with one glance. These days, those Elvis eyes of hers look more anxious than come hither. 3 years ago, Mia was a clerk reviewer for the Vancouver Police Department, clerical staff mostly, transcribing reports and liaising between the various agencies. She was sharp, made her way up to working for the superintendent, Arthur Sachs, in the anti-drug unit. The day our father was killed, she quit and never went back. Eventually took a job as a data technician for a pharmacy. Doesn't socialize the way she used to. When she's home, it seems like she's always cleaning. Angry cleaning. She scrubs the kitchen counter like it stole her wallet. Mia blinks at me a moment. I thought you were doing a double. Yeah, I was supposed to, but I got 3 hours into the shift and I had thought I was going to pass out. Had to find someone to cover me. Plus, I went in way early last night because Junie had something happen with her kid. I scratch at a crusted green smear at my top. Covered in barf and pee and creamed freaking broccoli. How come you never called me? Left two messages. She checks the screen of her cell phone. Oh, I figured you'd be busy. You had a double. Mia has zero problems working long hours. When she worked with the VPD, she was a civilian, but she worked cop hours. 12-hour shifts, lots of overtime. Before that, she worked in our father's law office. Edward J. Lynch, Esquire, routinely pulled 14-hour days. She used to prepare his documents and deal with the vermin he called clients. He was the one who bought her those designer suits. He'd tell her what to wear, right down to the height of her heels. Dad trusted Mia. They trusted each other, maybe because she was his firstborn, apple of his eye, etc. My little Mimi, he'd call her. Sometimes it got under my skin. She follows me into the kitchen now. I drop my bag on the island countertop, go to the sink and fill a glass, guzzling cold water. I look at her. Those are some wicked bags she's got. My sister used to be a champion sleeper. Not anymore. Must have a dozen different sleep concoctions. Setting the glass down, I sit on the stool and sigh. I once had an old guy at work tell me that he felt like he'd been beat with a wet cat. This morning, I understand that one in spades. Mia checks her phone again, then looks at me as if I'm taking up too much space. What? Am I cramping your style? What the heck's up with you? She pauses for 3, maybe 4 seconds. She's back.
Who?
Ivy. What? How do you know?
She called. She's back.
But... I look out the kitchen to our front door.
She's supposed to be dead.
Yeah, well, pop goes the weasel. Sweat pricks my forehead. Nobody really believed that Ivy was dead, but you'd think if she was going to fake it, she'd keep on keeping on.
When? Why didn't you tell me?
I'm telling you now. Mia opens a cupboard, reaches deep, and pulls out the bag of ginger snaps she's been hiding. She bites into a hard cookie and chews violently.
Apparently, she's been in Mexico. They found Maurice's head on a beach in Veracruz.
My stomach rolls. This is the kind of stuff we used to hear when Dad was alive. One of his clients' associates was found in the trunk of a burned-out car. Another one at the bottom of the English Bay, his feet in buckets of cement, scuba gear on his back. And then there's what happened to Eddie Lynch himself.
Why would she be coming here?
She said they took everything, threw her out on her bony butt.
They who?
How do I know? Luckily, they didn't slit her throat.
Not lucky for us. She wants to come over, says she left something.
Well, too bad. We chucked everything. I looked around the kitchen as if I need to protect myself. Not that Ivy was ever violent. It's just her. What she brings.
Mia washes her throat with more coffee.
I told her that. She's threatening me.
Threatened you?
So tired, my brain is starting to frizz. I don't want her here. I don't even want to look at her.
Well, if you'd stayed at finish that shift, you'd be in the clear now, wouldn't you?
The doorbell rings.
In the hall, Mia and I gawp at the transom window as if the Grim Reaper were on the other side.
Maybe she is.
I rub my palms on my pants.
The bell rings 3 times, quick. Knuckles rap at the door. I take a step and Mia grabs my wrist. 2 years older, 2 inches taller, she's my big sister. But sometimes, these days anyway, she gets so freaked out. Mia used to have this cool, sexy way of handling people, talking to them like the women in those old movies that she watched with Dad. Not anymore. If Mia has a problem, you don't know if she's going to burst into tears or punch you in the face. Now I have to be the big one, the calm one. The world turned upside down when Eddie Lynch was killed. A metallic rasp cuts the air as a key slides in. We listen to it rattle in the lock.
Oh, no, you don't, I mutter. Shoulders back, I stride to the door.
Claire! Mia hisses, "Don't!"
Ignoring her, I turn the deadbolt and fling the door wide. Ivy jerks upright, her useless old key still in the door.
Almost don't recognize her with the short blonde hair. Oh, but I'd nor that porcupine nose anywhere.
"What do you think you're doing?"
With big Jackie O shades, she wears jeans and a short blue trench. A navy tote bag hangs off her shoulder.
Nice to see you, too.
Those oversized sunglasses make her look like a fly. I watch my reflection in them.
Don't know why you're here, Ivy. We threw out everything you owned.
No, I doubt it, she says. Let me take a look.
Should have killed yourself for real.
Mia sounds so blasé vicious it startles me.
You always were a nasty piece, Ivy said. Impossible to see her eyes under those shades.
Don't push it, kiddo. We agreed. 10 minutes, and we never have to see each other again.
Mia takes a slow, deep breath, as if she's counting to 10.
Fine. Then she turns away.
They agreed?
Fine? Thanks for leaving that bit out, Mia.
I check the street, no one on the sidewalk, no one waiting in a car. Standing aside, I let her in. Ivy started out as a client of our father's, arrested for smuggling cocaine, I think. She flew to Seattle from Miami, then drove over the border with a suitcase. First thing she said when they busted her, "Get me Eddie Lynch." Ivy was a crony of one of my father's criminals. Eddie got her case tossed before it even went to court. Then he fell in love with her, or something. Dad had been single 6 years, ever since her mother met a guy and took off to Portugal. He never mentioned any woman. We were not expecting someone like Ivy to be the first. Slim, long dark hair, a wide, full mouth, bit like Mia, actually, but a coarse version. Rough skin and hard angles. Right after she moved in, Dad transferred the house into Mia and my name. Protecting himself financially, well, who knows. For my sister, Ivy was both insult and injury. Technically, this was now our house, yet we were stuck with a woman we didn't know and didn't like. I didn't have quite the hate on for her that Mia did. I was 21 years old and finishing up my nursing degree, up to my eyeballs with coursework. Mia had started with the VPD, so she wasn't home much either. But she was infuriated by Ivy's presence. In a way, I didn't blame her. Long before our mother left, it was as if Mia were Dad's soulmate. They laughed at the same jokes, finished each other's sentences. I remember coming downstairs late once when I couldn't sleep. Probably about 10 years old. The television was on, dialed down to a low murmur. Me and Daddy sat on the couch watching the same old black and white. On screen, a seductive woman said, "You know how to whistle, don't you? Just put your lips together and blow." Mia's lips formed the words as she watched. Eddie tucked her hair behind her ear. He gazed at her as if she were a harvest moon. The intimacy embarrassed me. I crept back upstairs. To be fair, the way he looked at Mia wasn't unusual. From the time she was a little girl, my sister had a magnetism. Heads turned when she came near, but none more than Eddie's. Then Ivy showed up. About 6 months after she moved in, Mia told Dad she was moving out. Told him? She was in his bedroom screaming at him. Said she was leaving and taking me with her. Before she could make good on her threats, he was dead. The two of us regard the back of Ivy's head as she surveys the hall, glances into the living room. Then she takes off her sunglasses and faces us. I can't help but gasp. There is a lurid bruise across Ivy's swollen right eye, a punch of purple and crimson on her cheekbone, flecks of pitch embedded in the skin as if someone shoved her face into asphalt, a blood-crusted gash on her brow. She eyes my scrubs. "Fix me up, Doc?" The shock of Ivy's face gives me an unwanted sympathy. I specialize in wound care, but the kind you'd find at a nursing home. Venous foot ulcers, pressure ulcers. Has anyone looked at that? I touched my own brow, probably too late for stitches. A crooked little smile crosses her mouth, as if she's bested me. "I'm alive, aren't I? More than some can say." There's a whiff of alcohol, like she hit the bar the moment she woke. Ivy is 13 years older than I. Makes her, what, 37? Jeez, she's a hard-looking woman. She gives Mia the once-over. "Wow, so much for little Mimi. Must have been the stress, huh, Mia?" Ivy looks pleased. Mia sneers with those broad lips of hers, narrow eyes, as if she might bite. Pop goes the weasel, I think. What I say is, okay, Ivy, let's get this over with. Ivy sucks her front teeth and starts down the hall. I think she'll head downstairs, but she walks right past the basement door and into the kitchen. Looking up at the tray ceiling, she runs a finger across the edge of the island's marble countertop. Then she turns to the buffet cabinet against the east wall, opens her coat, pulls a hip flask from the inside pocket, and unscrews the lid. The mouth of the thing is already coated with her red lipstick. "If you're supposed to be dead," I wonder aloud, "how did you cross the border?" Ivy winces as she takes a drink. That cheekbone of hers is probably broken. "New name, new passport," she eyes me, bruises and bravado. "A tough girl showing off in the schoolyard." Mia snorts. She folds her arm and leans back against the fridge. I look at my sister. Suddenly, I can't get that plinking jack-in-the-box tune out of my head. Around and round the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. Oh, I gotta go to bed. Can we not just be civil, let this wretched woman get her crap and get out of here? Facing Ivy, I try some of that civility. "Well, I'm sorry to hear about Maurice." Ivy shrugs. "He started knocking me around one night. Then he walked out, never came back. Next day, a bunch of guys showed up, said the place was the property of the cartel. The cook stayed. Rest of us were out." I was 15 the first time I heard Maurice Moreno's name. Dad had taken us to one of those five-star restaurants he liked. This one was known for being a scene, mostly the Hollywood North crowd. Eddie had just won a big case for a client that news outlets described as an alleged associate of a Colombian drug cartel. The place was loud with big-mouth conversation. A woman walked by our table and did a double take. I thought she was gawking at my sister. Another stranger about to tell Mia that she looked like a young Angela Jolie. Our mother muttered and looked away. In hindsight, she already had one foot out the door. Instead, the woman said, "Edward Lynch?" She introduced herself as a reporter from the Sun. "Well, that's quite a tie." He smoothed the bright flowered Versace and then told her what it cost. That was the kind of guy Eddie Lynch was. Sliding the pen from her coil-bound notepad, she said, "Guess it was worth it then." "Sure. Made in Italy. Those silkworms gotta eat." Let me rephrase. How does it feel to get a thug like Maurice Moreno off scot-free? Eddie grinned. I remember how oddly bright his teeth looked. "Feels rather good." "Doesn't bother your conscience?" "I have no problems with my conscience because every defendant, no matter how repugnant in the eyes of the courts or the media, has the right to an attorney." Without breaking eye contact, the reporter made a few scratches on her notepad. "Given the nature of the people you represent," she said, "aren't you afraid that one day one of your clients might deal with you the same way gangsters like Maurice Moreno deal with—" Eddie laughed. "Mr. Moreno is a businessman." Ivy screws the cap back on her flask and sets it on the counter. She walks to the side of the buffet, plants her hands on the corners, braces her feet, and starts pushing. "Hey!" I take a step, but I don't stop her. "Leave it alone," Mia snaps, and I don't know if she's talking to me or Ivy. Ivy pushes hard, and the cabinet rumbles 3 feet across the wood floor, my mother's abandoned china rattling inside. Brushing one hand off the other, Ivy eyes the empty wall, the cabinet's vague outline left on the paint. Then she goes into her tote. She pulls out a wallet, a full pint of Balvenie's whiskey, a claw hammer, and a small black pistol with the word Hellcat imprinted on the side. I shoot a glance to Mia. Her face is granite. Ivy pushes everything but the hammer back in her bag. I look at her. What are you going to do with that? Oh, don't worry, your pretty head. I'll throw you a couple of bucks. Then Ivy takes the thing in both hands, drops low, and swings it into the drywall. I flinch. There's a fist-sized hole near the floor now. Mia chews her bottom lip. I'm starting to wonder if I'm really here at all. Maybe I'm upstairs sleeping. Ivy swings and busts another hole, then another. Chunks of plaster fall, gypsum powders in the air. Flipping the hammer over, she uses the claw to tear off a slab, coughs as she exposes layers of bat insulation. Once she has a hole roughly 2 feet wide and a foot or more high, she reaches inside, first one way, then the other. Catching hold of something, she exhales hard, then hauls out what looks like a computer bag. White, soft-sided, with a red logo that reads, Fireproof. On her knees, she tears open the Velcro flaps and looks in. Drugs? Cash? Did Ivy hide this thing when Dad had the place repainted? Did they hide it together? A secret escape plan packed into the wall. Aren't you afraid that one day? She holds the bag like a child holds a teddy bear. Me and I watch in silence. Around and around the mulberry bush loops in my head like a nightmare, and I don't know why it won't stop. Ivy gets up from the floor, brushing bits of plaster off. She hefts the bag, perches on a stool, and catches her breath. The wall is a shredded mess, insulation hanging out like the tails of dead squirrels. Drywall litters the floor as dust continues to settle. Following my gaze, Ivy goes into the white bag and pulls out a strapped stack of cash. She pulls out several $100 bills and sets them on the counter. For your wall, I always pay my debts. Bit of a slur now. Ivy picks up her flask and gives it a shake. A drop plinks against the stainless steel. She goes to her tote bag and finds that pint of Balvenie's. Gripping the cap, she snaps the seal as she unscrews. Then she takes a thirsty mouthful of scotch. Mia gives her a look of disgust. Ah, jeez, go drink in an alley. Well, listen to you, Ivy sneers. Must put on 40 pounds. Know what they call that? Emotional eating. Shut your mouth. Mia straightens up to her full height. The thing with little Mimi is she's 5'10". In the old days, she probably weighed in at 130. These days, she's probably more like 165. Ivy's black eye shines under the pendant lights. She lays her hand on the tote bag. Mia runs her tongue across the edge of her front teeth as if she's thinking some thought. Why would you play dead if you had nothing to do with it? To do with what? Killing Eddie? What are you, nuts? They had all kinds of crap on me. I was scared out of my freaking mind when Maurice showed me those cop reports. Between what I was doing for Eddie, what I was doing for Maurice, the reports, Mia, remember? Maria's arm lifts as if she might backhand her. Don't think you want to do that, Ivy says, but go ahead and give it a try. That's enough, I say. My sister glowers at me and turns away. Fine, because I really don't want to hear it. The truth is, nobody knows who killed Eddie Lynch. His specialty was organized crime. He was in bed with gangsters from here to Montreal, New York to Mexico. More than once, he had occasion to fly down to Colombia. Here are the facts. 3 summers ago, at 6:30 on a Monday morning, our father walked out the front door, climbed into his black Audi convertible, and headed downtown to his office. 15 minutes later, he was dead, shot with 5 .45 caliber bullets shortly after he pulled into the underground parking of 475 West Georgia. 55 years old, CCTV footage shows a guy in a balaclava long black coat walk up to the car and shoot out the driver's window. The shooter ran, presumably into the office tower. No cameras in the stairwells. He didn't reappear on any cameras at all. Investigators called it a professional hit. They discovered copies of police reports in Dad's briefcase, confidential files he should never have had access to. In his pocket, they found the personal phone number of Superintendent Arthur Sachs, director of the anti-drug unit. Meehan and I were still in bed when the police showed up, staggered out of our rooms wondering who the heck was ringing the doorbell like that. I was numb and silent when they told us Eddie was dead. Mia sobbed. Her hands shook as if the world were coming down around her. Ivy wasn't home, and we couldn't get her on the cell. Turned out that she had rented a cabin cruiser at the marina and never returned. The Coast Guard found the boat a mile offshore along with Ivy's clothing, driver's license, and credit cards. They say drowned bodies usually show up within a few days. When they don't, a faked death can be suspected. We wondered if Ivy was part of the plot to kill our father, or if she was scared that she was next. Never knew for sure that she was alive until she showed up at our door today. Ivy takes a swallow of scotch. He was a son of a gun, but he took me in. My chest clenches. Eddie? Ivy flicks a look at the ceiling. Your father never loved me. I was just his bagman. Mia was his baby. He kept you out of jail, Mia says. Stupid coke mule. It was cash, not coke. Ivy's pupils are big and black and drunk now. I brought cash up from Florida. Was supposed to bring it to Eddie. Eddie was supposed to deliver it to someone else. I didn't ask who. Always better not to ask. Her fingers flutter up to her black eye. Eddie was supposed to deliver the cash. Was it for Superintendent Sachs? Arthur Sachs had to be in on it or something, or why would Eddie have his personal number? How did he get a hold of those police reports? That's what people wanted to know. An investigation of Sachs followed. Guys he worked with said Sachs had come into some money. Sachs told different stories of where that money had come from. Then, CTV News ran a full-blown exposé on the anti-drug unit, Sachs in particular. Days later, Sachs was found dead, shot himself with his own service weapon. Like a mind reader, Ivy mutters, "Oh, poor old Arthur Sachs." "Yeah, poor him." Mia moves to the sink, leans and stares out the window into the trees. "Sold out his whole department." Ivy watches her. Maurice had those files too. Now, how do you suppose Eddie and Maurice got that stuff? Ivy looks at me. My confusion must be obvious. "Ah, jeez," she said, "you're totally in the dark, aren't you? This is one messed up family." Mia keeps looking out the window, as if she's watching a scene play out far, far away. Ivy shakes her head. "So many details in those reports. I thought Eddie must be selling us both out." She takes another swig from her Balvenie's. Her battered face is suddenly melancholy. "That's how it is with us girls. Chew us up, spit us out. Hey, Mia?" Mia's voice is low and guttural. "Speak for yourself." Ivy scoffs, gets spittle on her lips. I've never seen her sloppy like this. She gives my sister a world-weary sigh. You're gonna have to face it sooner or later, little Mimi. Sachs, Maurice, that biker lawyer was, what was his name? Who else did Daddy pimp you out to? Mia wheels. She takes two long strides, snatches the hammer from the counter. Ivy launches off the stool. The computer bag dumps on the floor. She stumbles, reaching for her tote, her pistol. Mia screeches as she swings. The steel claw hits Ivy's head. Ivy slams sideways into the marble counter, and then she slumps down on the floor. I get my hold of my sister from behind, my arms wrapped around her, as if there's a point now. The hammer falls from her hand with a thud. Mia starts to keen, "You stupid woman, stupid, stupid, I hate you, hate you, I hate him so much." I ease Mia onto a stool where Ivy sat. Ivy is still, a gash in the side of her skull, dark red oozing through her pale yellow hair. Kneeling beside her, I check her carotid pulse. Nothing. "This isn't happening. It's not real." Stunned, I sit on the floor, my back against the buffet. Mia swings her head back and forth. Another pitch of babble comes out. "Everything, always, always. If he wanted it, I did it, I did it." She looks at me, her eyes red and raw. "He pushed me to get on with the VPD, and I did it. But I never got the right reports. I wanted the good stuff from Arthur Sachs. He sent it up. So it told me to where Arthur had lunch where he..." Then that terrible mewling noise again. I couldn't stand him anymore. Screw him. "Daddy?" I felt dizzy. Don't quite know what I'm asking. "I wanted Maurice to do it. I told him in bed. Maurice Moreno's bed." She repeats as if that's the worst of it. Her mouth hangs for a moment. "Told him Daddy was an informant. That's how they were going to get him. He didn't believe me. He wasn't. Was he? How did he end up with Sack's number?" Mia puts both hands over her face. "You?" She nods. "Not just Arthur. He wouldn't stop pushing me. He wanted, always wanted. I did whatever he wanted. The pig. And then he brought her in here." She blinks down at Ivy. For a moment, all I can see is that grainy CCTV footage, as if it's on a big screen. The guy in the balaclava, the long black coat shooting out the driver's window. Mia knew Dad's schedule better than her own. Suddenly, the balaclava is off. "You came home and put your pajamas back on like nothing happened." Mia looks at me and swallows. Where did you get the gun?" I ask. "Maurice's drawer." Then she adds, "I put it back, pleading, as if I needed to know she's not a thief." "Did Maurice know?" She shakes her head. "I thought they'd trace it back to him. Would have been perfect. Both of them finished." She closed her eyes and takes a shuddering breath. "He thought you were too good for his dirty work." She starts talking about Dad again. "Not me. No, I was just trash." My own tears slide. "Don't say that. I want to tell her how I thought the two of them had some special bond, that he never loved me like her. But I didn't know what's true, what's real. I'm so darn tired. I can't think." And all around the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. "Oh, gee, shut up, make it stop. Kill that plinking monkey in my head." Then it does stop. Everything quiet. Quiet. Dozing in the blue like clouds, I am locked in a puff of white, white noise. Minutes passed. Days? Am I in bed, in the sky, in the ground? I don't know. Eventually, I hear birds squabbling outside the kitchen window. Water is running. I look up and see my sister on the other side of the island. She's at the sink, splashing her face with cool water. Turning off the tap, she pats herself dry with a paper towel. 3 feet from me is Ivy's lifeless body, pooling blood, the hammer. Mia, what are we going to do? My voice sounds limp and childish, as if I'm 10 years old again, and she's so grown up. She doesn't answer. Did I actually speak or only think it? Mia, what are we going to do? We have to call 911. Mia comes around the island, looks at Ivy. Why? She unbuttons the cuffs of her long black shirt and starts rolling her sleeves. She's dead. Mia's got that low, sultry Lauren Bacall voice she learned on the couch. Been dead for years. My sister's hooded eyes look the way they used to, like our father's. A sparkling tenacity that said he would have what he wanted. Mia helps me up. She's the calm one again, the one who knows how to whistle. Come on, she says. Let's get you into bed. I look back at Ivy. Mia steers me out of the room and down the hall. Walking up the stairs to the second floor, the strength of my big sister is comforting. I'd almost forgotten how she could be. Mia, we have to... Shh, come on, baby. I'm going to give you something to help you sleep. When you wake up, it'll be like nothing happened. All right, I'm switching over to a different Ellery Queen mystery magazine. Mia Dahlia brings us our next story, and it's called In the Shadows. Oh, go on, tell me all about it, she drawls, gesturing with her drink. And I still cannot resist the drunken seduction in her voice. Tell me how the golden age is coming, how nothing will ever be the same. But I warn you, she sways and catches herself on the bar top, steadies, cursing gravity, and continues. I warn you, nothing good will come of it. Ava Delacroix, the love of my life, the inebriated angel of my dreams. I still remember seeing her for the first time, the electricity of that moment jarring my senses from head to toe. She was holding a knife, kneeling in a pool of blood and crying, wailing in anguish over the lover she had just killed. Broke your heart, Ava did. And then the director yelled, cut! The scene was over. Ava dropped the knife, turned away, and despite the ghosts of tears still glistening in her eyes, gave the wickedest grin. The room burst into applause. I just sat in my corner, speechless, pen poised above the screenplay I'd been hired to fine-tune, forgotten. I had never seen anyone like her. Later that night, in a local basement speakeasy, everyone favored after a long day on set, she approached me. I wasn't even drinking then. Well, is that water? She said, the deep drawl of her voice honey thick and strikingly at odds with her cosmopolitan appearance. I nodded. Well, it's nice to see someone take prohibition seriously. She laughed and threw back a glass of something clear. Vodka? Gin? Moonshine? My name is Charles Moore. I know who you are, she interrupted. I saw you on set today. She did an inimitable thing with her eyebrow. You were gawking. I could feel myself blush and hope the darkness of the room would absorb my embarrassment. You were magnificent, I told her sincerely. She smiled a mischievous smile. Oh, now I have heard every compliment under the sun, you know. I can imagine. Tell me one I haven't. I'll trade you a kiss for it. Once again, Ava had managed to render me mute, an alarming sensation for someone who's made his living out of words. I'll think about it, I offered lamely. She winked and left, moving on to more eloquent and interesting companions. I chugged the glass of water on my table, wishing myself invisible. But I did think about it. It was all I thought about as I meandered through my days. I watched Ava and thought of ways to impress her. I tweaked the screenplay to beef up her role. I followed the popular cast and crew around, always on the outskirts, skimming the periphery. Slowly but steadily, I got to know these people and what made them tick. The production wrapped up, and I was hired for the next one. It was a great confidence builder. I cast away my old fedora and bought a proper hat. Though for Ava's premiere, I still had to borrow a suit. I watched her there, basking in the spotlight, and it struck me then, the right thing to say. I found her afterward and whispered it into her ear. She was as good as her word, and her kiss was worth the wait. We worked together on the next movie. Defying all odds, she took me to her bed. "I don't know how to love," she told me, "but I'll try to be good to you." I would have settled for less. In the outer space, stars perpetuate for eons. In Hollywood, their lifespan is tragically short. I would have thought it'd be the aging or the drinking, but no. It was the talkies. The enemy is seldom what you expect. "Sorry, doll, but no one wants to hear you talk," said Ava's manager bluntly. She scoffed at the idea of elocution lessons, played it off as a joke, like the talkies were just another passing fad. "I've reinvented myself enough already," she said, punctuating her words with a perfect smoke ring. And she had, having gone from a small-town preacher's daughter with a clumsy name to a silver screen legend. Maybe there's only so far one can go to change oneself. "I was never ashamed of my past, you know," she told me once in a rare, candid moment. "I figured as much," I replied. "You wouldn't have chosen Delacroix of the cross if you were." "Ah, darling, too clever, by far," she laughed and kissed me. "But one doesn't have to be ashamed of something you want to leave it all behind." I viewed the invention of the talkies as the necessary evolution for the format and figured Ava would come to recognize it too. She didn't. The drinking increased as the rolls dried up. "Well, I'm just another has-been now," she said during her waves of self-pity. "Leave me," she'd push. "I know you're gonna." I couldn't if I tried. She was the beating heart of me. I wanted to help, and so I did the only thing I was good at. I wrote a script. "Well, I read it," Warren said, rubbing his broad forehead with a meaty paw. I had made a lot of connections over the years, using them sparsely, always saving for the rainy day. Now it's pouring, and I'm reaching for the highest ground. That's Warren, the nosebleed heights of Hollywood success, a studio head at one of the top five. "And?" I prompt politely. He sighs. I study the man. His immaculate haircut costs more than my suit. In his immaculate suit of fine gray wool cost likely more than all of mine combined. I am making a decent living, but Ava is expensive. Besides, I never went in for fashion. Nowadays, you can't even wear a nice, dark, somber suit with a plain shirt. Everything has to be three pieces with patterns, too. If you can swing it. Life, it feels, is changing quicker than I am comfortable with. from movies that talk to suits that dazzle. Don't get me even started on the music. At least the booze is still illegal, and everyone is still drinking. It's a tough sell, Warren offers finally. You see the jazz singer? Of course. Everyone's seen the jazz singer. No going back from that. No returns to silence. But my movie would talk, I protest. Only Ava wouldn't. A mute femme fatale. He shakes his large head. Not a single brilliantine hair moves. How's that gonna work? It will. You know Ava. She can be irresistible without saying a word. Well, maybe 5 years back. Now I'm not so sure. I'll take a pay cut, I say, throwing in all I have. Whatever it takes. You know the script is good. It's interesting, Warren concedes. I didn't peg her for the killer until the last few pages. That's exactly it, I clap my hands together. And no one else will either. It'll be the twisting end that they'll be talking about everywhere. Warren gets up to look out the enormous window that makes up nearly the entire wall of his office. The people below hustle like so many ants. How must it feel to have that kind of power, to decide the fate of others? Well, let me talk to some people, he said finally. I do like the title. It'll look great on posters. In the Shadows commences shooting a few months later. I thought maintaining control of the script would be my main challenge, but no, it actually was keeping Ava sober enough for the shoots. What's the matter? She says, draping herself all over me, voluptuous curves upon an out-of-fashion suit. Not like I have any lines to remember. I know this isn't a permanent solution. Stubborn and willful as she is, Ava will sooner drink herself to death than adapt to the new world. I know she will leave me behind the same way Hollywood will forget her name. But I just can't let go, not yet. I'll hold on with all I have until the final act because, well, look at her. There's no one like her. She is the brightest star in the universe. Well, my universe, anyway. I'll hold on to that for as long as I can. We are all addicts here, playing a make-believe. Fame, alcohol, love, everyone wants something beyond reason. Maybe the best we can do is give to each other what we crave the most. Maybe that is the closest we can come to grace. Besides, Ava has always looked great, awash in blood. Backlit by the shadows, there is a sort of heightened sense of drama to her features, a pending tragedy in her eyes. And every so often, she can steal her expression into a perfect blade's edge, a woman born to play killers, not victims. The plot is simple but effective. A woman survives a brutal attack that leaves her mute and obsessed with her assailant. She begins to follow him around, repulsed at first, but eventually coming to understand and even share his passion for violence. The more she gives into it, the more it overcomes her. It's almost like one of the popular vampire pictures, only the monsters here are human. The trick is in revealing the truth slowly and strategically, one delicious morsel at a time. When the audience sees Ava finally step out of the shadows to kill, it's a revelation. Her expression is mesmeric. Like a deadly snake, she hypnotizes her victim before striking. Eventually, the victim and her attacker end up together, drawn in by their lethal appetites. It's a romance certain to end in murder, but for the moment, the two of them achieve a perfect balancing act, suspended on the high wire of danger and desire. It's a love story, Ava said upon first reading the script. She laughed. Don't go soft on me, Charlie. I merely shrugged. The shooting goes as smoothly as it can be. The leading man is a newcomer, Edward Castle. He doesn't like Ed and bristles at Eddie. Castle is a stage actor transitioning to the silver screen. He certainly has the voice for it. In silent cinema, he wouldn't have made it. His acting is much too subtle. Oh, but for the talkies, he is perfect. He can make his voice go from the seductive, melodious baritone to the most sinister, harsh hissing. How he does it is absolutely remarkable. He can do the same with his eyes, too, which is purely unsettling. On screen, the scenes between him and Ava burn with scorching intensity. I'm surprised they don't combust the film stock. I'd be jealous if I ever had any claim of ownership of Ava's heart. But I know what I am here, a temporary custodian, not a conqueror, and I have made my peace with it. Just like the movie, my relationship with Ava thrives in the shadows. The blinding light of day exposes us for the frauds that we are. Two mismatched souls who tell lies for a living. In the darkness, we can each pretend to be someone else, someone better. We still go home together, at the end of the day, still fall asleep in the same bed. What we dream of is a different story. The shooting wraps up on time. Warren takes everyone out to celebrate, and then we don't hear from him. Every day the silence grates more and more. Eventually I get a meeting with him. He slaps my back with forced jollity and calls me, "Hey, old friend," so I know the news cannot be good. "Yeah, the studio's shelving the film," he tells me at last, having the decency to meet my eye. "What? Why? I've been forbidding myself to even entertain this possibility, and now I no longer have that luxury, no more bliss of ignorance for me." "Yeah, they did some screen testing and found it too disturbing." It seems we have been tried and found wanting in the court of public opinion. The public, whose morality is as narrow as their minds, gets to decide if our beautiful movie lives or dies. "So that's it?" I ask him. "That's it, I'm afraid. Short of a miracle." "A miracle," I echo bitterly. "Look, there'll be others," Warren says conciliatorily. "Maybe not for Ava, but for you, oh, certainly. You've got talent. Your name carries weight." Warren doesn't get it. I didn't have the wherewithal to explain. I thank him and get out of the suddenly claustrophobic cigar box of success in that office. I go home and get spectacularly drunk for the first time in my life. Ava returns from who knows where and joins me. She doesn't even have to ask. "You were carrying on about miracles last night," Ava tells me the next morning over coffee. "The daylight's too bright and every noise feels like a personal attack. Christmas is months away." I let that thought cycle through the drains of my mind. "Oh, that was something Warren said. How it would take a miracle to put our movie in the cinemas." She looked up at me thoughtfully, chewing her bottom lip, then goes back to buttering her toast. That's the last we talk about it. From there on, it's a steady downward spiral into oblivion. "We're all vampires in this business, you know," Ava told me once. "We all long for immortality at all costs." "Oh, come on, surely not." "Well, why do you do it then?" She pointed at me with her drink. "Because I'm no good at anything else," I wanted to tell her. "Not really. And since I met you, I do whatever it takes to be near you. But I didn't want to be accused of being over-sentimentally, so I merely shrugged." "Well, I do," Ava said with sadness in her voice. "I want to live forever." The truth is, I made up stories because I'm no good at everyday life. I come up with fictional twists and turns to make up for failing to foresee the real ones, which is no excuse, but at least something of an explanation for how I find myself in the here and now. On the living room floor of our house, looking up at Ava, there in her eyes is an expression as close to love as I'd ever seen. I want to reach for her, but I can't. I can't move at all. "I'm sorry," she says. "I'm so sorry, Charlie, dear. I just couldn't think of any other way." She kneels beside me into what I notice is a pool of blood. It takes a moment to realize the blood is mine. There is a knife glinting in her hand, one of our better kitchen knives. I think I can hear the cars pulling up outside, loud voices and footsteps, then a heavy banging on the front door. Ava starts crying. It looks as good as it ever did on screen. "It's a miracle," she says, but so quietly, I'm not sure I hear it right. And then she stabs herself in the heart. I lose consciousness just as the policemen burst in. There's no such thing as bad publicity, after all. An on-screen murderess turns one in real life. It's simply too irresistible. In the Shadows is promptly unshelved and released to rave reviews. It's the talk of the town, an overnight success. I am bombarded by the press, too weak to respond and too numb to care. The studio hires a team of lawyers to deal with the logistics. I've already done my part by not dying. The rest is Hollywood history. "Hey, smile, buddy," Warren says when he visits, plopping his bulk on a chair next to me by the window, where I've been observing the view with an indifferent gaze. He's perfectly groomed and tactless as ever. "You're a legend. So is Ava, for that matter. A crazy broad. But she's going to be remembered, that's for sure. It's like, whatchamacallit? Immortality," I tell him with a bitter smile. "It's like immortality." Then I turn my wheelchair away from the window and toward the shadows lingering in the corner of the room. It's better there. Easier on the eyes. Well, folks, that's going to bring an end to this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Again, I'm truly grateful that you joined me, and I ask you again to tune in again next time. Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.